You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Friends, I invite us to listen for God's word through Luke's gospel in the 10 chapters, 25 through 37.
Our words of wisdom are excerpts from Luke chapter 10, verses 25 through 37.
Just then a lawyer stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he said, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?"
He said to him, "What is written in the law? What do you read there?"
He answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself."
And he said to him, "You have given the right answer. Do this and you will live."
But wanting to justify himself, he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?"
Jesus replied, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of robbers, who stripped him, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. Now by chance a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, while traveling, came near him, and when he saw him, he was moved with pity. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, having poured oil and wine on them. Then he put him on his animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, and said, 'Take care of him, and when I come back, I will repay you whatever more you spend.' Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers?"
He said, "The one who showed him mercy."
Jesus said to him, "Go and do likewise."
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Well, like I said, it's been a little while since I've been in a pulpit. I was a Presbyterian pastor for 23 years. David made that. And the other one that introduced me, including the rabble of rousers, the part I did not do that. I was a Presbyterian. I still am technically a Presbyterian minister. In our tradition, a pastor serves the church. A minister is the ordination. So I'm technically still ordained. I used to be a full-time pastor and part-time photographer for 37 years, and now the reverse. In 2024, I began a full-time career as a portrait photographer, and it has been a lifelong dream to do this full-time, to help people create beautiful art of themselves, but it has also been a wild ride as I'm learning how to also be an entrepreneur and a business owner, but it has been a good one. I learned a couple things in both of these occupations, actually. I realized that when I'm not being intentional, when I get caught up in the task before me, whether it is church administration or photographing someone, within about 4 seconds of meeting someone, I too often have already decided who they are. Have you done that?
Yeah.
And as a photographer, then, I spend the rest of the photo session creating images based on that decision, unfortunately. If I'm not intentional, I miss the person standing in front of me. And I never know what I miss. I never get the chance to get to know them. So I try to be intentional. I learn about my clients. When I meet my clients for the first time in person, I've actually already met them because I've been to their home, I've met their kids. I've seen the artwork on their walls and how we can do better. I mean, how they can create more work. A little bit ago, we prayed together. And we said, I don't know if you remember this in the liturgy, we said, Spirit of Holy Hospitality, you make the world our neighbor. You might have glossed over it. I don't know about you, but sometimes I just sort of say the words without really thinking about them and what's coming next and when's the coffee coming.
Yeah.
We said we would remember neighbors far and near. And we said the door of new life is open to anyone who knocks. Do you remember that part? I like that prayer. That's a good prayer. I didn't write it. I don't think we were lying when we said that, were we? Nobody's nodding or shaking. They're like, no, I wasn't lying. So you're okay. I don't know Methodism very well, so I don't know what your traditions are. I only want to point out one thing about it, though. The man in Jesus' parable, the man in the ditch, he can't knock. He can't knock. He's unconscious. He doesn't have the ability. We have this lawyer who stands up to test Jesus, and he asks, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus asks, well, you're the one that has studied this stuff, so what does it say? What does the law say? And the man answers perfectly like a good Jewish lawyer. Love God with everything you have, and love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus says, you got it right. Congratulations. Do this, and you will live. That should be the end of it, right? But Luke tells us why the lawyer asks this next question, wanting to justify himself. And he asks the question, so who's my neighbor? Hear what that actually is, what he is actually saying. He is not confused. I think he knows very clearly what he's asking, like any good lawyer should. He is asking for a boundary. He's asking where his responsibility stops, because a man who has to love his neighbor needs to know, how many neighbors are there? Can I afford this? He's asking who he can stop being responsible for that. So Jesus tells him about a road, not just any road, a very particular road. A man going down from Jerusalem, down to Jericho, about a 17-mile road. He falls into the hands of robbers. They strip him, they beat him, and they leave him half dead. They took his clothes. They took his clothes. Now, in the first century, your clothing announced who you were, your identity, where you came from, what you did, what kind of money did you have, where are you, one of us or one of them? Are you safe? And he is unconscious. So nobody can hear how he speaks, his word choice, his accent. Those were two ways you were identified as a stranger, and the robbers took both of those things. They didn't just rob him. They took his identity. Half dead. Not dying entirely, but also not entirely dead. Which means even those basic questions anyone would ask about a body lying by the road, is he alive, cannot be answered from a distance. You have to get up close. So here's a man with whom nothing can be determined, not his nationality, not his religion, not his politics, not his worth. He may be the only person, I think, in the Christian Testament who cannot be sorted, who cannot be categorized. And a priest comes down the road, sees him, and passes by on the other side. Then a Levite, kind of an assistant priest, sees him, and again, passes by on the other side. I have heard probably 100 sermons about this parable and why they pass on the other side. Anybody have a guess? What's that? Fear. Fear of what?
Yeah.
Fear of the other? They're priests. Fear of disease. Fear of impurity. Right? But they're coming down from Jerusalem. Their official duties are done. They're coming down from Jerusalem. And it wasn't a sin to touch a dead body. But there were regular rituals that they touched dead bodies all the time because they prepared people for burial. Corpse impurity, a ritual obligation. It's tiny. It's an easy scapegoat for us. And I have even preached that myself. And it is mostly a Christian invention, used to make Judaism a religion of rules and Christianity a religion of love and acceptance. And it is silent. I preach it. Because Luke does not actually give us a reason. Not one word. They saw the man and they crossed the road, and Luke does not tell us why. And I think that silence is deliberate. If Jesus had given the priest a reason, every one of us would now be evaluating that reason right now, deciding whether it was good enough, and quietly noting, well, we could have done better. And here's what I finally noticed. After preaching the story wrong for so many years and so many times, nothing says that man was outside the priest's circle. They assume. Just like I assume within 4 seconds, I know the person standing in front of me that I'm about to photograph. Nobody could know whom he was. The priest declined to even find out. That is a different kind of story. And a worse one, because now knowing is free. Not knowing is freedom. I can move on. I don't know. I'm not going to get involved. But knowing creates a potential obligation. I know I have to do something. And one more thing. Priest, Levi, everyone listening knew what that third person was supposed to be. Priest, Levite, Israelite. Of course, the hero of the story, right? The third man is the ordinary faithful layperson, the one sitting in the pew, the one who is you and me, well, you and now I said used to. That is the whole pleasure of the story, right? Because you get to be the one who stops and has compassion. But Jesus trades that slot. There is no Israelite. There is only an enemy. And you should know who that enemy is. Samaritans were not foreigners. They were Israelites who kept the same Torah. The dispute was about where God is properly worshipped, on their mountain or down in Jerusalem. But the story the Judeans told was that they had mixed blood with foreign settlers and descendants of traitors. But that story we know is propaganda. And that's what we did. The United States did it to the Japanese during World War II. Germans did it to Jews and socialists and other people, homosexuals and others during World War II. Colonists did it to, and during the 1800s, during the Civil War, we did it to people of African descent. The other, the fearful other. That is propaganda, not history. It is a file that somebody kept on their neighbors, which means the people listening had nowhere at all to be in the story except one place. In the ditch. They were the ones in the ditch. Now, I want to talk about this room right here, and I'm a guest here, I know, so I will be brief. David's going to regret this. I do not think this is a congregation that fails to welcome people. A stranger comes to that door, and before they leave, there is a mug waiting for them. What does it say? We put love first. A beautiful gesture of warmth and welcome. And I will tell you now that I have admired this congregation for years, the work that you do. I would only point out what a mug does. It says, we put love first. It is a sentence about you. And it is a powerful sentence. And we hand a stranger an object that tells them who we are, who you are as a congregation. And in the same motion, tells them who they have just become. A loving one. It is hospitality. It is also gently an ID card. You're not one of us yet. You're not one of us yet. And lots of churches do this. And it's a good thing, and I don't want to discourage it. I'm looking forward to having my... But I wonder about the people who are hard to pan and bug to. The visitor who says something clumsy about their gay nephew while obviously painfully meaning well. Yet that person is still welcome. They are simply maybe no longer as interesting. Everyone keeps smiling and something quietly closes.
Nope.
We don't exclude them, but we categorize them. We label them. And notice what we needed in order to do it. We needed to hear their accent. We needed to hear their language. And we decided within seconds where they fit. And I wonder about the one, maybe some of you might be thinking about, if they were to walk through this door, how they would be welcomed here as well. Somebody walks in wearing a particular red baseball cap with white capital letters on it. I want to make the argument against welcoming him at full strength, to be honest. It's not what you think. Because it is not a bad argument. That hat is not an opinion about tax policy. In this room, it is a statement about whether some of the people sitting here get to exist. Whether some of the people in our communities get to have rights. And asking those people to sit next to that hat so the rest of us can feel generous is not hospitality. It is building the vulnerable for the cost of our vision. And I think it is right to have boundaries. I'm not going to stand up here, especially as a guest, and tell you to take that boundary down. But notice something about
the hat.
A hat is clothing, and we oblige the clothing instantly. From one piece of fabric, we know who this person is, or we think we know who this person is. We know something about what they're about. We know what we would do if he found us bleeding by the side of the road. Or we think we do. We have built an entire human being out of a hat and called it a serpent. I'm including myself in this. That is the priest's failure,
is it not?
The priest would not even find out. We are certain we already have, and both of us agree that we will get something, both of us get something out of it, which is permission to keep walking. That is not something that I want to get part of. That's my boundary. I'm going to keep walking. But the priest and the Levite didn't even find out. And we make assumptions about it. We can keep the boundary. I do not think we can keep the certainty. Because people are more than just that fact. People are more than just their clothing. And more than just their voice or their accent. So one chapter earlier in Luke, a Samaritan village refuses to receive Jesus, and James and John ask whether they should call down fire and burn it. I actually love that scene. I love their fervor. And Jesus says, no, we're going to move on. The refusal to receive him is allowed to stand. And what gets condemned is actually their wish to destroy the people who refuse them. Notice what the Samaritan does not do. He does not invite the man into his community or ask what he believes or require him to agree with anything. He doesn't even learn his name. He binds the wounds, oil, wine, bandages, puts him on his own animal, takes him to an inn, 2 days' wages, and an open account. Whatever more you spend, I will repay. Mercy, in this story, is a bill. Mercy is not membership. We collapse those, I think, sometimes in this story. We think we have to welcome everybody with open arms, without boundaries, without conditions. We assume that if we cannot let someone in, then we owe them nothing. And so we give them instead is contempt. And a story that we tell each other. The word for what happens inside the Samaritan gets translated moved with compassion. He's moved with compassion. It literally means his guts were turned over. It's a visceral feeling, not just a Hallmark card. In the Gospels, that verb almost always belongs to God or to Jesus or to the Father who sees his lost son coming down the road. Here, it belongs to a heretic, an outsider. We sang Ubi Caritas, beautiful, beautiful.
Yep.
Where charity and love are, God is here. Not sent, not dispatched from somewhere else to come fix things. It's just there. It's present. It's our presence with one another, God's presence. In the gut of the wrong person on a road with no witnesses, it's there. It takes the man to the inn, and the Greek word means the place that receives all. We call it an inn because we don't really have a good English equivalent. Not the place that welcomes all, the place that receives all. Not the place that has made up its mind about who is receiving. A place that takes in whoever arrives, because at least some of them cannot say who they were or where they came from. Think of one person in your life that you maybe have filed away because of a hat.
Thank you.
Maybe because of one other thing. Not a category, a person, a human being, a child of God with a name, who you have finished deciding about, is your God. And I'm not asking you to invite them to dinner, or to agree with them, or to take down that wall that you built for probably a good reason. But find out one true thing about them that you did not know, that recognizes even their humanity. Just one. And perhaps the priest's sin was not hatred. There's not a word about hatred in this parable. His sin was that he did not want
Terry.
And that is a far more comfortable sin. Because ignorance is. In a few moments, we're going to sing Draw the Circle Wide. Sing it. I think we are, right? Are we? Okay, good. Sing it. I mean it. It's a good song, and you should sing it like you mean it, because I believe that you do. I would only ask you to notice, while you are singing, the man in the story was never inside that glossy circle. He was lying in a ditch, his clothes gone, his identity gone, unable to say a word on his own behalf. And unable to knock on the door, let alone crawl into a circle to be. Somebody's guts turned over and that's it.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information, or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.